necessary to improve the county. And also, on the website, we have over 170 meetings throughout the United States and Canada as a result of this level of this program. And without further ado, I also want to introduce a very good friend of mine, Joe Lewis, and also been a lot of them, who have been with us today.
Lordy, Lordy, what'd I walk into tonight? I'm so very, very honored to have been invited to come up here to tell my story at Wolf Creek. I've never felt more ill-prepared or unqualified to do so, but these two guys really got me going tonight. That was utterly fantastic. Can I take you home with me? Anybody in here one day away from 24 years of sobriety? Stand up, Larry. Well, my name is Cliff Bishop, and I'm a real alcoholic. Also a serious and very enthusiastic member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because of a loving God I found through our 12 steps, a loving and lovely Al-Anon wife, Joe taught me how to follow the direction that came with the steps in the big book of many, many people exactly like you. I haven't had a drink since February 5th, 1983. And I, by God's love, living sober. By God. First time I heard the preamble, the way Bill wrote it, was right here. And I thought, what on earth is he talking about? Second time I heard it, I thought, why did we ever change it? Because it tells it more like it is than I think we understand today. But I'm supposed to tell you a little bit of what I'm like, or what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And what I was like was a kid growing up in Oklahoma and never fit in anything at all. I met a young lady when I was 14, and we started going together on and off for a while, and then World War II was coming along, and I felt very patriotic, and I volunteered, and 2 or 3 weeks later we got married. And for 63 years, we shared a life that very few people have been able to experience. But my drinking, I'm not going any further with that at the moment. I may in a moment at the end. But drinking was not a part of my life. It being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous sure wasn't on my things to do list, I'll tell you. I'd never even considered the possibility, and well, here I am, the best thing that ever happened to me, being an alcoholic and winding up running Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've been given two opportunities to survive alcoholism. The first one I blew. I became a drinker, I'll say, as a result of a job I've been offered back in, 1956-57. Guy thought maybe I'd be, 53, that I might be a pretty good salesman. And so he called me a few times, and I really wasn't interested in getting into the job because it required traveling. My dad had been a traveling salesman, and we never had a relationship, and I just wasn't interested in getting into that thing. But Henry kept after me, and I was going to a conference down in New Orleans, and Henry called and said, "Can I come down and visit with you while you're there?" And I said, "That sounds great to me, come on." He told me to meet him at the cocktail lounge of the Jung Hotel, and I did at 5:30, and we had a couple of drinks, and we went down to the French Quarter. I lived in Ponca City, Oklahoma at that time, and here I am in the French Quarter of New Orleans. And Henry had been there before, so he knew where to take me. And I saw things happen I didn't know people could do. I mean, it just was an experience that was like anything I ever imagined. And we got back to the hotel about 4 o'clock in the morning, and he said, "Meet me for breakfast at 8:30, and I did. He said, "How do you feel?" And I said, "Well, I feel pretty good, a little tired, but I had a wonderful time last night." And he said, "Yes, you did, but you passed your drinking test. Now we can get down to serious business." And then he proceeded to tell me what it was that I would expect if I accepted his job. Well, for a while I resisted it, and then finally something happened and made me think maybe it's worthwhile, so we took it and moved to Dallas. And one of the things we did was we drank. We carried a briefcase, we wore white shirts, dark ties, dark suits, and we drank alcohol. And I thought it was pretty nice and neat stuff, because all of a sudden I found something that made me fit with these people. And after a couple of years, they decided I ought to be promoted and moved out to Pasadena. And they gave me a going away party, and that's when I had my first blackout. I'd been working awfully hard trying to get ready to go, and really didn't understand what had happened, but I'd been in the house having a good time with the people there at the party, and I came to out in the backyard on my hands and knees, and I said, "How did I get out here?" And they said, "You've just been having a wonderful time." And I thought, this is not something that I can, it's going to happen again, I just don't have to worry about it. Well, it wasn't very long before it started happening with great frequency. And the guy that hired me got promoted to a vice president level and moved out to California so they'd need me back to take his job. And he realigned the country and gave me the whole NASA program, the southern third of the United States, so far as our company was concerned. And it was exciting. I knew the first seven astronauts. I worked with three of them and putting instrumentation into the Mercury, a little bit in the Gemini, and I was gone before the Apollo got going. But alcohol started taking a toll on me, and my boss named Chuck had he just thought the world of me. And when they saw things getting so bad, he decided they would move me to California and make me marketing manager for the international division. You couldn't pick a more ideal job for an alcoholic, right? Because you leave the country, you can't drink the water, and going to Europe is a wonderful place to not drink water because the wine is fantastic. But back coming back from there 6 weeks later, I was drunk. And I went up to the hospital one more time. Back in the 60s when AA found me, the hospitals wouldn't take us to where any treatment facilities. There wasn't any place to go, but you either sobered up in jail or the AA group. But I had a doctor that lied. He came up with 7 different diagnoses for admitting me to a hospital. And then about 10 years ago, he retired. And the last time I saw him, I said, "Bill, why on earth did you make it lie for me that many times to save my life?" And he said, "Cliff, I don't know." And I just wondered, and I kept on wondering. But when I got home from that trip, it was very obvious that I no longer could control my drinking, and so Chuck flew in and fired me. That was the most devastating thing that ever happened to me. My wife was getting a divorce, my daughter hated my guts, my son didn't have anything to do with me, I didn't have a friend on her. Totally unimportant. But they were awfully good to me. They gave me 6 months severance, so we didn't start with it. But when he fired me, I went back to the bedroom with my bottle of vodka, and I got serious about my drinking. And for the next 16 days, Elaine went out daily and got me a bottle and brought it in. I'm not sure whether she's trying to fish me off or trying to protect the citizens of the community, but nevertheless, she was bringing the booze in, keeping me in the house. And a few years ago, we were talking about that. I got reminiscing a little bit about the good old days. And she said, "Clever, when you went by doing all your drinking, did you go to different liquor stores so people wouldn't think maybe you had a drinking problem?" I said, "Well, of course. Why?" "Yes." She said, "Well, those days I was buying your booze, I went to different liquor stores so they wouldn't think I had a drinking problem." And I said, "Baby, you don't know or remember what a drinking problem you had, because I was laying back there in that bed dying." Now, the doctor told me he'd run out of ideas, I need to go to AA. And he said, "I'm not going to see you again if you don't go see my favorite psychiatrist." He was a member of his class. And I went to see Dr. Temkin, and Dr. Temkin listened to me for 1 hour, charged me $35, and told me, "Mr. Bishop, people who drink the way you do are beyond psychiatric help. I suggest you go to Alcoholics Anonymous." I thought, man, what a ripoff, $35 to be told something, and just a big lie. So I went to my minister, and our minister put a lot of time in and with my family and trying to help me, and finally said, "Cliff, you're beyond hope. You better go to Alcoholics Anonymous." I heard Robert Reed a while ago, and you did too. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Well, if a doctor, a psychiatrist, and a minister can't do it, where are we going to go? But on the 16th day, I came to sit on the side of the bed with my head in my hands and my nose filled, and I realized I was really, really near dead. And I offered a prayer that I've heard a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous say they pray, "Dear God, what on earth can I do?" Well, the only thing I had got through that was, "Why don't you call Alcoholics Anonymous?" So I stumbled up into the family room. Elaine was sitting there, and I told her to call Alcoholics Anonymous for me. She did, handed me the phone, and I mumbled into it. She said there wasn't a chance that anybody could have understood what I said. So they had a little game plan going, and when I hung up and went back, I realized I'd made a mistake. And I went back and found my bottle and had a good pull on it. I remember that. She called that minister, the minister called a member of the congregation of that church, and in about 15 minutes, there was this guy out of our house. And I remember Jim had on a brown suit, a brown tie, and a white shirt. He was a member of our church, and I knew what he was going to tell me, and I didn't want to hear it. But apparently what Jim did was he told me his story. Now, I cannot remember a single thing that Jim said. But he obviously penetrated me enough, so I let him put me in his car. And as my daughter knows, I hate to say a passenger in anybody's car. And took me down to the old town north there in Dallas. And Jim set me down in front of a guy named Tom Ferguson. He was a resident of the group at that time. And he told me his story. And when he got through, Tom said, "Cliff, you think you're an alcoholic?" I said, "Tom, I really don't know." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what you do. You have old Jim get you a bottle of anything you want on the way home. You go have two or three drinks. If you can do that, and put it up, you're okay, but if you drink the whole damn thing, you're an explicit alcoholic, you better get back here." Well, Jim did, I did, and I was back the next day. And I consider September 15th, 1964, one of the most important days of my life, because that was the day I finally gave up and asked for help. Seriously. Now, back at that time, as I said, we didn't have anything but AA and clubs and jail to sober up in. And so they sobered me up on orange juice and honey and a little bit of bay rum, and I started going into DTs. And for 6 weeks, I really wasn't very much aware of what was going on. But I did recognize one thing. When I walked in there and I smelled alcoholism, that aroma. And I saw somebody laying there vibrating, going through that agony we go through and drying out. I knew one thing for sure, I didn't want to drink. And for 5 years, I hung in real solid, and, well, not quite. I think I must have started letting up, because long about 1969, I saw an opportunity. It was just too good to turn down, and so I went after it. In May of 1970, I had completed 5 years of sobriety, and I'd been working up the office, and started home that night, and I thought I'd better go by and make a report. Now, this doctor that saved my life had asked me to work with one of his patients. Now, I had no more business working with an alcoholic than anybody else at that time, but I gave him my best shot, and Bill called me that afternoon. He said, "Cliff, you don't have to worry about Jack anymore." He took his 12-gauge, blew his stuck in his mouth, and blew his head off today. And I thought, that's a pretty neat 50-year present. So I stopped by the group and I asked the chairperson if I could have a minute at the end of the meeting. He said, "Yep." And I got up and said, "Well, my name's Cliff. I'm an alcoholic. 5 years ago today, I had my last drink," and they started to applaud. And I said, "That isn't what I came by for. I came by to let you know that the guy that I've been trying to help committed suicide. He blew his head off today. And that was my gift for my 5th birthday. And I want you all to know this thing really works and you keep coming back." 3 months shy, 13 years later, I was back exceedingly drunk one more time. And there had been a tremendous change in the fellowship in the meeting rooms at that time. During that 13 years I was out there, we'd gone from having alcoholics laying around that we could help sober up to where we had everybody cleaned up, and very few speaker meetings, but a lot of things called discussion meetings, and at first I thought they were pretty good. I liked them because At that time, this job business that I'd gotten into, I'd elected to develop my business over in East Texas. Loved to fish back at that time, so I could make the business with place. And most of my business was in Tyler, Longview, and Paris, Texas, and around there. And one of my good buddies was a taper in Dallas, and he kept me supplied in Texas. So I had an AA or Al-Anon meeting going all the time, and I could pick up, you know, hear Clancy or Chamberlain or some of our icons and pick up some of their witty things. So I get back to the meeting where I sit down and pop those things, and at the end of the meeting they say, "Cliff, I love what you said. Well, if you're an egotist like I am, well, that's all you need to get ready for the next meeting, right?" The only problem was that after feeling so good at the beginning, I started feeling real bad. In fact, along about 6 or 7 months, I sat on the side of the bed with my deer rifle in my mouth, and I couldn't think of a thing was wrong except I couldn't stand it. And I guess about the only reason I didn't go ahead and pull the trigger is I remember Jack and the misery and devastation he placed on his family. I just resisted. But all this time I'm driving with these tapes, I had one that I don't know where it came from and I don't know what happened to it, but it had to be the guy's name was Joe and he lived in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I played that one over and over and over. Now, Lane and I used to go up the White River. We were up there several times a year. We just loved going up to Jack Place, and that was sort of our hangout. And every time I came through Little Rock after I heard that tape, I was wondering, you know, is there any chance you could find a guy named Joe in Little Rock? And I thought, that's got to be one of the most stupid ideas on earth. I think Little Rock's a pretty big place, and say, do you know a guy named Joe? If I said Joe McHugh, I'm sure that the vast majority said, oh, yeah, he's down 2500 South Broadway. But I didn't do that. Well, my precious daughter bought herself a little old red Porsche back when they first started coming into popularity. And one of the things those people did that bought those Porsches, they had the kind of a little clam. If you were driving down the street and you saw anybody in a Porsche, went beep, beep, and waved at them. Well, she loved that little game, but one day she's driving down the street and here's a little boy in a Porsche, and he's over the side of the road, and he's had a flat tire, and being a good nurse that she is and wanted to help people, well, she stopped to help him. Well, they started going together, and then they got married, and Jim came from Russellville, and he was working there in Dallas, and then all of a sudden he had a chance to get a job in Little Rock. So they moved up here. I finally got back to AA in February of 83. And first time we came up to see Carol was Christmas week in 1983. And the thought was in my mind a good bit. I wonder if there's any chance I can find this guy Joe in AA since we're up here. Now, I felt a little bit insecure being away from home for the first time since we'd been back. So I picked up the telephone directory, and Carol's going to get on me for this, but she said, "What are you doing, Daddy?" And I said, "I'm trying to find an AA group." And she said, "Do you mean you're back in AA, and for the first time you've been up here, you've got to go to an AA meeting?" And I said, "Honey, I think you all want me to stay sober. Now, I don't have a choice what I do, but you do. I've got to go to find a meeting." God really, you know, he is so capable. Joe said he is sufficient. He is sufficient. There is no doubt. Wall Street was only 2 months old. Now, as I recall, the gang cut a deal here with the Baptist Hospital in October, moved in, and I was up here in December. And it wasn't anything like it is now. It was still pretty well much of a mess. But the people that had committed to this thing were supplying probably know the history better than I do, but I just happened to be here at that particular time. And Joe was in one of the rooms doing some work. And it came time for the meeting, and he came on in and sat down, and I remember that meeting so well. Because the topic was step three. And what I was hearing in that meeting was so unlike what I was hearing in Dallas. It just was a totally different thing. I had the chairperson looked over my left shoulder and he said, Joe, what do you think? And I turn around and here's this voice in person. And I thought, oh my God, how on earth did that be? After the meeting, I told Joe I'd heard this tape and I'd really been looking forward to the opportunity to visit with him. And I'd say, is there any chance you can give me some time while I'm here? And he said, sure. I said, you got some time? Well, let's go on down to the house now. And he took me down to Serenity House. We sat there in the meeting room for a while and visited, and I'd give anything if I had a recording of what Joe said, because I know what he said and what I heard were two totally different things, not essence. I don't know that Joe has the ability to chew on anybody or, you know, get rough with them at all. He's the most loving man that I've ever met. But sitting there talking, Joe helped me understand three things. One, I did not know what alcoholism was. Two, I didn't have a clue what the program was. Three, I was a part of that segment of our fellowship that was killing alcoholics through our ignorance. He hurt my feelings because I was big stuff back in that group I was going to. And he took me down to nothing. He introduced me to a book titled Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember so clearly Joe introducing the first paragraph of the foreword to the first edition, and all of you real hard-nosed big book know what it says. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. He said, do you know that? And I said, no, I didn't. I'd never bothered to read it. He spent a little bit more time with me and he helped me understand what alcoholism was. He helped me understand I was powerless because of a physical allergy. My life was unmanageable because I'd been totally unable to manage a decision to resist the temptation of that first drink. You see, about 16 years after my last meeting, I drove 70 miles for a six-pack of beer. I'd been hunting all day, a beautiful day. I was like old bread, not a cloud in the sky. And I said, I had my motel room in Tyler, dry as a bone, and I got back there and sat on the side of the bed. And I said, man, wouldn't a beer taste good? York, the whole committee up in my head said, man, wouldn't it ever? So I just went to Kilgore, 70 miles round trip for a six-pack of beer. There is the insanity. And I had not a drink in 16 years. The insidious insanity. Caused me to drive 70 miles for a six pack. I didn't even like beer, for God's sake. That's not drinking. But I did remember one thing. If you drink on a flight, you know, when you've got food in your stomach, it's not quite as bad, right? So I got a bag of beer nuts and I headed back to the motel. And I had a handful of beer nuts and I popped a beer and I took a drink, and I remember the folks told me, if you ever drink again, you'll die, and nothing happened. Ate some more beer nuts and drank some more beer and finished up that beer, and another thing had happened. I said, you suckers lied to me. I wasted 5 years hanging out with you. That's how it started. So Joe helped me understand the second part of step one, which I have never been able to understand, because in the meetings I've been going to, the unmanageability of step one was I couldn't balance my checkbook. I couldn't make my job work the way I was supposed to. I had all kinds of things. My life was unmanageable. And Joe said, simple. If you could resist, you know, taking that first drink, you wouldn't be here. Now, that's too simple. That's how simple it is. And here, 19 years after AA found me, all of a sudden, I'm becoming an alcoholic. And before I left Joe that afternoon, I was an alcoholic of a hopeless variety, and I knew it right down here. And boy, what a peace of mind it was to know. Not wondering anymore, but really knowing. And then he kind of tricked me into step two. Again, I don't remember the words, but the idea was, do you think this thing is working for me? And I said, my God, is it ever? He said, do you have any hope it might work for you? And I said, oh, do I ever? Sitting here listening to you, and at the time I've listened to your tape, he said, there's a hope. I can believe that maybe this will work for you too. And I thought, my God, that's step two. It's not all this other stuff. We've been parenting. simply the hope that maybe if I do what he did, I too could get what he got. And then step three became real simple. Go do what I did. A decision to take the rest of the steps. Well, that's kind of where he left me. You go home, give your sponsor, take your steps. And got back home, and I was so indoctrinated with the meetings, and I still, my ego was still floating a little bit with that hip slicking cool stuff that I love to spout in those meetings. And I just sort of passed it off. And one day I was up at a meeting, and Paul, the guy that I had picked as my speaker, Paul was a guy who couldn't make it back in the 60s. I used to take coffee to him. You don't put that much in a cup. Said he put any more in it, he'd vibrate so bad he'd scald himself. And I don't know if anybody had more 30-day chance than old Paul did. Second Sunday back, a guy named Paul was up there telling me his story, and when he got about 10 minutes into the story, I, my God, honey, that's Paul. That's that sucker I used to take coffee to, and he's got 15 years of brain. So I went up to him after the meeting, I said, Paul, you may or may not remember me, because you didn't stay sober very well back when I was here in the 60s, but you owe me, because I took you a hell of a lot of coffee, and now you're going to be my sponsor. So we worked. Anyway, I met him up in meeting one night, and he said, how are you doing? I said, fine. He said, have you taken your 4 steps since you've been back? And I said, you think I ought to? Now, I don't know if you recognize it, but that's a very stupid question to ask a sponsor. And I said, when do you want to do it? He said, can you get Elaine out of here next Sunday at 1:30? And I said, yes, I can. And so 1:30, he showed up. Elaine walked out the door. And Paul walked in. Now, Paul had been worked over by a guy named Clarence Snyder. He lost a good bit of it during that 13-year transition, but there was one thing he knew how to do, and that was pull the truth out of the person. But he walked in, and he said, are you ready? And I said, yes, sir. He said, get on your knees. We went in the front room, and I got on my knees. He said, pray the prayer. I prayed the prayer. God, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. Here I am on my knees in front of a guy. I'm not puking this time. I'm praying. And I don't think I'd ever been more serious about anything in my life I was at that moment. And I finished that prayer, and he said, get up, sat down. I got up, sat down. He pushed a yellow pad, a legal pad in front of me. He said, write your name, date, this is your 4-step inventory. And I did. And he said, who are you pissed off at? And I told him, he said, why? And I told him, he said, that's pretty selfish. And it made me write in the margin. Apparently, he led me through a process that Abby did with Bill, something along that line. When Abby took Bill through the process of recovery in Towns Hospital. In about 2.5-3 hours, Paul had wrung out of me all of my resentments, all of my fears, all of my sexual misconduct, and had it on down there in front of me. And he said, do you see what a selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, pride, inconsiderate noun that I won't use? And I said, yes, I do. He said, do you like what you see? And I said, no, I do not. He said, are you willing to go to any length to become different? And I said, I sure am. Who do you want me to take my 5th step with? He said, quick, you're ready for 7th step. Again, the simplicity of our program totally escaped me. He said, you spend your hour, and if you're really serious about it, tell God you are and get on with it. I went and spent my hour, and I didn't feel all that much bad. I felt relief in one aspect. I wouldn't have to do it again. You know, that thing's a done deal. I'm through. Elaine takes a little supper, and the God I've come to know and love has a wonderful sense of humor. Because that night on TV, for the first time, was a movie titled The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And right in the middle of that thing, the room lit up, there was a feeling of peace that I had never, ever known before. And I felt it just flow through. And for about 20 minutes, I sat there totally mesmerized by this totally unknown, ungodly feeling. And the effort's over, I told Elaine what had happened. And during that period of time, 2 thoughts came to mind. One is, I'll never ever have to have another drink, and the other one is, I'll never have another problem. Now, I hadn't become a student of the Big Book. I didn't know that promise was there printed in black on white on page 45, very clear. But the Big Book is a source to find a solution that will solve all our problems. And I told Elaine what had happened, and I said, honey, will you go back to the bedroom with me and Let's thank God for what's happened to me and happened to us, because I know from here on things are going to be totally different. And we did, and I went in and I called Paul and told him what happened, and he said, well, that's nice, you'll sleep well tonight, thanks for calling, I'll see you tomorrow. And I said, wait a minute, Paul, for God's sake, did you hear what I said? He said, oh yeah, I heard. And he said, you'll sleep well tonight, thanks for calling, I'll see you tomorrow. I didn't know if that sucker had gotten so good at this that he had taken 300 to 400 people through the fourth, fifth, sixth step. And most of the time, they had a life-changing spiritual experience. But after that, I said, what do you want me to do, Paul? He said, don't drink, go to meetings. I say, Paul had been successful in making that transition. And we came back up to see Carol, and I came over to see Joe and tell him what had happened, and again, thank him for getting me started the way he did. We sat there visiting a little bit, and he kind of asked me, well, how are you doing on 5th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th? Well, I've been doing great on 5th, 12th. I don't know how many alcoholics I killed doing 5th, 12th. But one thing that I was so vacant of when I got back was, we didn't have any alcoholics laying around anymore. Everybody came in, they had their makeup on where it belonged, it was, their lipstick wasn't up on their forehead, you know. And the guys were all cut up, shaving if they even tried. The smell was gone. The reminder of where I came from and where I could go again wasn't in the meeting room. And so I went looking. First of all, I wound up volunteering down at our county hospital in a large part of the place called Parkland. They let me volunteer in an emergency room, and boy, we caught them coming off the street, all shapes and sizes. I found out a little bit later across the street, Salvation Army had a drunk tank. There was the best place on God's earth to do 12-step work. The cops brought them in. We had them for 5 days, and before the 5 days were over, I had a chance to do my favorite thing. Sat down in front of a suffering alcoholic and tell him my story. From that became an invitation to take it down to the Adult Rehab Center of Salvation Army. And from that point on, it's been one invitation after another. But the thing that was so intriguing to me, after I saw Joe, I started doing something totally different. He helped me understand that step 8 was almost a done deal. He helped me understand the simplicity of doing step 9. He helped me understand the importance of step 10, how vital it is that I do step 10, to learn to do it, to keep my pride in my hip pocket, and be willing to admit to one other human being my damn selfishness had resurrected itself again. To do step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 12 is all step 10 was about. I didn't know that. I thought it was something you'd do at night. And no, I found out that the simplicity, the utter simplicity of what I did to have that spiritual experience is what I'm going to have to do day in and day out, moment by moment, day by day, to keep the slate clean so when I sat down at night and start having a visit with my Heavenly Father, I can go over and see how well I did step 10 during the day. I haven't done it perfect yet, never will. So it always gives me something to contemplate at that time. And then I do ask Him, you know, forgive me and show me what I can do better tomorrow. He's way ahead of me on this, I'll tell you. But step 12 is where we live, and I didn't understand it. Step 12 is a whole bottom line for this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so very, very thrilled to find out what to do and how to do it. To sat down with an alcoholic and tell him my story and what I knew of alcoholism. And somewhere along the line, Joe helped me remember the simplicity of Bill Wilson. Going out in search of an alcoholic to preserve his sobriety, not really concerned whether or not the person he got a hold of was going to buy into his program or not. But he wound up talking to a very prominent surgeon in Akron, Ohio. His surgeon had agreed to give this sucker from New York 15 minutes, but that's all, and then he's going to go home and have a drink, right? Bill, for the first time, did it the right way. He sat down and described alcoholism in scientific terms, told him a little bit of how he understood it from his own experience. And Dr. Brown said, I'll be damned, that's it. I am hopeless. I'm helpless. There's nothing I can do that's going to save me, Bill, but look at you. What do you do? Bill told him. 3 weeks later, Dr. Bob had his last drink. Alcoholics Anonymous was born. It took him 18 months to find 10 people to have a group of, say, 10 people. One of the things I did, used to go to conferences and roundups and whatnot. Don't do it much anymore, but one of the godsends was a thing called Man to Man out in Brownwood, Texas. And I lay out there for several years, and I guess the last one I went to, an old boy named Gene Lott. I'll mention Gene's name now because he's gone on. But Gene lived in Tulsa, and he and I had become very good friends while we were out there. And we were talking about what I had learned through Joe, and I didn't know that he had also been touched by the same person. But he told me about a big, big seminar. Now, Joe and Charlie had been to Dallas with the big, you know, the weekend deal, and boy, I hate that. And following that is when I started a big, big study in my home because I couldn't get any degrees. So he didn't want to, let's see, what was the expression? Decrease the effectiveness of their group by including a big book study. So I started this thing at home. But Gene mentioned while we were out there, he said, Cliff, we're having the first big book seminar in Tulsa, and he said, I think you'd really get something out of it. And I thought, well, this is kind of ridiculous. Here we got the big book study going at home, and I've been to Joe and Charlie a couple of times, and I can't see any virtue in driving all the way to Tulsa, just hear more of it. But Joe and Charlie happened to be at the Shalom group up in Denton. I was committed on Friday night and Saturday, so I didn't get to go up, but I went up Sunday morning. And Charlie said, you can expect Cliff on Sunday morning, because that's when we talk about sex, so he'll show up. But after it was over, I mentioned this big book seminar to Joe, and I said, what do you think? And he said, I'd like to see you there. I think it'd be a great learning experience. Joe had become my mentor prior to that time. I remember very clearly we were sitting over at the Rennie house one day, and all of a sudden it just really, really dawned on me the impact this man had had on me, the influence. And I looked at him and I said, Joe, I don't know whether you're going to like it or not, but like it or not, you become my sponsor. And I know he's going to say, I ain't got time to mess with you, sucker. But Joe didn't. He just smiled and said, thank you. And he is a man who has taught me the simplicity of our program and how to put it to work. And he said, I'd like for you to be there. Well, that's all it took. I'm going to be there. You know, I drove up to Tulsa. Joe and Charlie, John and Willie put on a performance like I have never seen anywhere in my life. They covered the big book, they covered the 12 and 12. They had two special sessions on the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts, and I got an insight on Alcoholics Anonymous that I never thought I'd see before. Now, I had been to the big book study up here. And with Joe there and Larry and his gang that were in that thing, I thought, you know, there's the power. I'd love to have one, but I haven't got what it takes. Well, at that seminar, I met a guy named Gene, as I say, up at Brownwood. He said he had a group like that, and I met old Joe Mack. He's taking our Joe's place in the Joe and Charlie thing. And they told me they were doing this, and I said, I've got to see it. So January, in that big ice storm we had in 1988, Gene called and said, I'm going to be home this week. If you want to come up, come on. So I said, well, how about the ice storm? He said, well, careful. Doing what you're supposed to, God will look after you so you'll make it okay. We got up there, and I swear I never saw anything like it. I mean, that ice was everywhere. But we went over to the original Westside group, old Joseph group, that first night, and there were everybody had a big book, and they were sitting around there. I guess there were well in excess of 100 of them on that real bad night, and they were studying the big book, and I sat there in absolute awe. Next day I went over to Gene's group, the Sobriety Live group, and I watched the same thing happen. Most of the people coming from work had their big book. That's when Gene had a sales call to make that afternoon. And I sat there in Gene's dining area, the snow and ice were on the ground, and I was sitting there looking out the backyard, the birds were up there. And I had a little visit with God, and I said, God, if it's your will, I want a group like this back home. I need a group like this. And I sent a note to Joe and told him what we were thinking about, and he sent one back, and he said if we could have a group like they have in Tulsa in every community, it'd make a tremendous difference in the lives of a lot of alcoholics. Well, first thing you gotta do is find a place. I'd already checked it out with Paul and George and some of the others, and they were positive about it. But after I'd returned from that trip to Tulsa, I had one of the guys I'd been in scouting with passed away. And I went to the church that we had belonged to for many years for his celebration of life. Now, the minister that tried to save my life and help my family, he got into one of these little political things that go on in churches, and they ran him off, and I got a hate toward that congregation. It was just awful. And I finally realized I can't go to church hating people. So I just quit. For over 20 years, I did not bother to go except for that celebration of life. And while I was sitting there, it occurred to me, I have made amends with these people. Found out how you make amends to your church. You call the minister and tell him, need to have a little bit of time with him, and I did, and I told him I'm an alcoholic, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've carried this resentment for over 20 years, and I am so ashamed of myself and so full of regret. What on earth can I do to make amends? And I looked up, and he had tears in his eyes. He said, my God, Cliff, he said, you're an answer to a prayer. We have people in church that I don't know what to do with. Maybe you can help them. Well, when I got back from that trip to Tulsa, I called Stan and I said, can I come see you? And he said, yeah, I'd be happy to see you. And I told him, I said, now, we're getting a group together and we need a place to meet. And I was just wondering if there's any chance we can meet here in the church. And he said, Cliff, I've been intending to call you because we have decided we'd like to extend our outreach activities, and we thought maybe a group of Alcoholics Anonymous would be very appropriate. So on January 26, 1988, we had our founders meeting. And we took an awful lot of shots. We've had a lot of criticism. There are people in Alcoholics Anonymous who do not like the big lip. Did you know that? They don't want to hear about it. I went to one meeting and they told me, don't you mention a big book in here. So I got up and left. But we went, we had about 70 to begin, and we downsized probably 25 or 30 because a lot of folks couldn't stand the heat. They just were more concerned with pleasing people than they were learning what the problem was. But as time has gone on, we stuck in there and we fought it through. And the thing that has been so amazing to me in following the pattern of the Dunbar Group, Big Vic Study Group, of the over 1,300 weekly meetings we have in Dallas, Texas, our Tuesday night meeting is the largest of all 1,300. And because we had developed a reputation of carrying the message of a program of recovery into some wind-up places, we now have been invited to bring this message of the Big Vic into over 30. Each and every week. That precious lady that I've mentioned that was a part of my life for 67 years passed away in April. She'd had a very long illness the last 3.5 years. It was my real privilege to be able to take care of her and keep her home. And my precious daughter was such a strong element of that. But when we had the viewing, the doctor who had saved my life showed up and just blew us away. I hadn't heard from him. I'd called a couple of times, but we hadn't made contact. But Bill showed up that night. And, of course, all the kids in the group know my story of how that doctor saved my life back in the 60s by lying to the hospital as to why he put me in. He met a whole bunch of our kids and finally took me back in the hall and he said, Cliff, I remember. You asked me that question, why on earth I lied? He said, tonight I just found out I know the answer. And he said one other thing. He said, if only one person had made their life count the way you have. Now over 30 years of medical practice were more than worthwhile. I don't know how that cracked you, but here is a poor puking alcoholic that finally found a guy named Joe that listened to him and found out the simplicity of our program was given to us by our first 100. He's been able to follow a pattern that Joe sat down for us. I had it some time back. I was going through looking at images, and here was a great big bonfire. And I thought, you know, that's Joe. And I got a little thing put together for him. He took and hit it someplace, which he always does. But right in the middle of that big bonfire is the name Joe McHugh. And this bonfire's got a lot of sparks flying at it. And I said, one of those sparks landed in Dallas, Texas, and ignited another spiritual bonfire. And the spark coming out of that bonfire are lighting bonfires all around the world. I had no idea what I was walking into when I met that man. All in the path that he's laid down for us, I've finally been able to make my life count. Really, really count. And I know so many in here are experiencing the same thing. I think most of you know Joe's story. How many thousands of people are alive and sober today because a guy wound up in a nut house in Benton, Arkansas, seeing asylum, trying to find a way to stay sober. And was told there's going to be a guy comes in here tonight, and they're going to bring in a thermos of coffee and a carton of cigarettes. And Joe was still smoking cigarettes at that time, and all they had was roll your own. And he's coming off a bad drunk. He wasn't doing very well rolling those cigarettes. So what he did was he'd hand him the bag and the papers to one of the nuts, and they'd pack the back in it, roll it, lick it, and hand it back to him. And finally Joe got, well, you know, I'm putting their slobbers in my mouth, and that don't sound too slim. So if I can get a cup of coffee and a pack of cigarettes, I'll sit here and listen to this guy lecture on the evils of drinking. It's worth a trade. Well, it didn't work that way. It happened to be Charles. The man who Joe told Joe, well, I'll tell you what I did. I don't give a damn what you do. If you want this thing, I'll help you. I don't know what more to say. I have never felt more blessed than I have up here today. So honored to be here. And so unqualified to stand here in this group and share my life story. That my life story is what it is because of what goes on here. I don't know if anybody told you they love you today, but God, I do. I love every single alcoholic I've ever met, and a lot of them I haven't met, because as of the last count, we've got almost 100 groups around the country that have found out what we do, which is what the Dunbar group does, and they're patterning themselves after what we do. No, I love you dearly, because as long as I'm with you, I have everything on God's earth. When I left you, I became a drunken bum, so I'm here to stay this time. I tell my kids I missed the opportunity to be a good-looking corpse 42 years ago. I'm going to stick around for the last act now. But I've had the good fortune to spend the afternoon with Joe, and I can't tell you how much that man means to me, how much I love him, and how thankful I am, and so many, many others. You're getting prayers from around the world. I told him today when I showed up here, if I gave him all the hugs that I've been asked to give, hug him, he wouldn't be breathing now. He'd squeeze the life out of him. But thank you for letting me be here. I thank you so very, very much. And those of you here in a little while, I hope you know how privileged you are to have Joe and Larry and the gang here that have picked up that one mantle. We've had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. This is the message we're going to carry. And if you want what we got, we'll help you get it. If you don't, go away. There. That's it. Thank you for letting me be here. Thank you. deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power.